Hello and welcome to the first episode of Just Us Talking, where it's going to be just us talking. I'm your host, Saurabh Dubey, and in this series, I call my friends, colleagues, and experts to talk about common things. Things we talk about will range from technology to business to just general things in our work life. For our very first episode, I have with us Adam Hutton, who is a close friend and colleague and my go-to guy for just talking and having the conversation that you need once in a while to stimulate your brain cells when the routine of work starts taking over. Today's main topic is going to be low-code platforms. Low-code, no-code has been the big deal in the last 5 years. And our intent is for this conversation to be somewhat of an introduction, but only the conversation itself will decide where we end up going with this one. Before we begin, Adam, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself for our audience?
Sure. So Adam Hutton, I'm a specialist director in KPMG's ServiceNow practice. So been working in IT service management and low-code platforms, namely the ServiceNow platform, for about the past decade. Prior to that, did some operations and business strategy consulting. Most of my time spent in IT and other types of enterprise service delivery. But over the years, mostly working on how companies adopt low-code platforms like ServiceNow.
Adam was our firm's number one person who got into low-code platforms. I was number two at that level. So
literally in the same room.
Well, so Adam, for our audience today, right? So let's start with some basic, right? What are low-code platforms? What do we mean when we say, when we use the phrase low-code, no-code? Really, what are some of the examples? Have people heard of that stuff?
Yeah, so low-code platforms, I would say they kind of started out with less development platforms or kind of predefined stacks. They've evolved over the years. So probably the most popular one years and years ago was that had a lot of market penetration and still does, is Salesforce's Force.com as a platform. Obviously, ServiceNow as a platform. It started out as an ITSM platform. There's Google Forms and Google and the Microsoft Power Apps. But I think like one of the early ones was around Yahoo and some of their microservices, which could be somewhat considered a...
You could consider Lotus Notes.
Oh, gosh. Lotus Notes and Remedy, BMC Remedy, wasn't really meant to be one, but became one. Yeah, Lotus Notes I would put as one. Excel. Microsoft Access probably is a big one that has been a terrifying amount of the world economy runs out of Microsoft Access databases.
So let me ask you this. If I was to make try to make a scientific cutoff between what's considered low code, no code, and what's considered therefore code, how would you differentiate between them? Because the list of things that we laid out require a whole different set of knowledge, right? We talked about Microsoft Access, which requires very clearly the knowledge of some core database technologies and things like that. We talked about Google Forms, which is way easier compared to that. It's a much different place. We've talked about ServiceNow. Of course, you and I work in that space, so we know that it's you still require some amount of knowledge of some basic scripting and things. And then we also kind of mentioned how Remedy picked itself up and got to the level of being considered as a low-code platform, even though the amount of specialization required or knowledge required for that is quite a bit. So if we were to make a scientific cutoff saying this is low-code and this is, code, what would that be?
It's almost like, if you're a developer, do you get to pick what you want to work in? If you're working out of a tool like Remedy, you don't really have a choice. If you're working out of a tool, Force.com, if you're working out of ServiceNow, you get what the vendor gives you as frameworks to operate within. And now in many corporate environments, you're also restricted. If you're just a pure developer, you often have a lot of restrictions in what you can build and what you can develop in. But it's a lot more freedom in terms of what frameworks you want to pull in, what artifacts and what repositories you want to use. So maybe it's vendor packaging, I guess, is a way to kind of group it.
Let me try and break this down, right? This is my perspective. This is by no means a formal answer to the statement, but this is my perspective on this. I think low code and no code are where it ranges from the minimum amount of knowledge required to start becoming an actual developer, right? So when we talk about drag and drop widgets, when we talk about seemingly English-like or I guess understandable language-like commands, that's where we are playing in low code, no code, right? For instance, when we develop stuff, right, when we are in the pure coding mode and we are doing, you know, we're working with resources and libraries and this and that, we need to know a specific vocabulary. We need to operate with a specific set of baseline knowledge, which you do not need in case of low code. Your baseline in that case is much lower when we talk about low code, which is why it's low code, and no code is, you know, typically, like, I would put something like IFTTT in a no-code bucket, right? Because it is a platform. It is a platform where you don't actually need to know how to code at all. Can you actually have plugins within IFTTT that have APIs that you can code and you can make real things with? Yes. I mean, one gentleman that you and I both know, Marco, once showed me some of the stuff that he had done with IFTTT and his Fitbit combined and all the sorts of stuff that he had done with it. But does every other user need to go that far? No. I mean, the basic users are, well, if my phone does this, then do this to send this message to my desktop, something like that. So that's what the no-code world would be. And the low-code world, which is where we live in, is where you do need to know some basic knowledge if you want to have advanced skills within the platform. So if we talk Appian or ServiceNow, or for that matter, Force.com, the basics are straightforward. They are drag and drop. They are selectable from drop-downs. They are, you know, even the flows can be designed pretty much as simple as the IFTTT model. But if you do want to go advanced, there is a capability that you can go ahead and say, you know, I'm going to code this in JavaScript, and then I'm going to make an Angular-based front end, which will have these fancy, you know, photogenic things in there, and it'll do some magic tricks. That, of course, requires you to have some more coding. So low code doesn't really mean that, you know, it's always just the baseline. It's just that your baseline knowledge required to start coding in there is much lower than what it would be in any other open platforms. What do you think?
Yeah, I totally agree. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. So I think it's probably good that we're making a differentiation on this call between low-code, no-code platforms and citizen developers and developers types of operations, because I think that's the... Yes, in a lot of the low-code platforms, you're writing less code, but that doesn't mean you necessarily need to. You don't need to act like in a developer mindset, at least to some extent. That kind of comes into play on how much reliance do you have on the application itself. So if you're a business, if you're in a business operations and you're heavily reliant on the for some business process, the thing that you built, whether or not it was built in low-code or no-code. The diligence that's there with respect to testing, maintenance, planning, at least some level of architecture and design and intent on what you're doing to make sure you're meeting requirements. And if you change those requirements, you don't have to rebuild the entire thing from scratch. So there's a level of diligence that still has to be there, even if it's a low-code platform.
Fair. So now that we've got a baseline of what a low-code, no-code platform is and how are they different from, you know, full stack development and other activities, let's talk a little bit about really why those are important. Why are they now in conversations? Why are they coming to the table, right? So you want to take us through just the high level perspective of why should a company think about using low-code platforms in the first place?
So it's the traditional problem of companies trying to define what their developers work in, right? So in the past, obviously when organizations were primarily build it from scratch shops, and there's still a lot of companies that operate like that, they have to do a lot of artifact management, a lot of planning of what repos do we use, what is authorized for use, what is considered secure, and then, you know, how do we manage having developers operate in 30 different languages on 20 different frameworks and hundreds of different frameworks, and how do we actually train people when they come on board? How do we move people between teams? That is a completely different ballgame when everybody gets to define their own framework and every business unit gets to use their own tools that they want. So over the years, clients and organizations have been trying to standardize on stacks of what we build things on and what we run things on. Going to low-code platforms is kind of a way to leapfrog that a little bit in that you don't really get the choice. You can't, like I said earlier, you can't bring your own everything, right? You have to operate in a set of standards. So One of the ideas there, I've been seeing a lot of organizations, is defining a set of enterprise standard platforms. So be that SAP for ERP functions and manufacturing and accounting, be that maybe Salesforce for CRM functions and sales coordination, and then obviously ServiceNow is a ESM type of technology for different platform use cases, different ticketing types of operations, and then alongside that you'll have frameworks in AWS and Microsoft Azure, and you know, here's how we're going to build future sets of applications from the ground up. So it's not so much as organizations are going to one, but they're going to, okay, we're bracketing these use cases into these delivery platforms just so we can maintain them easier and just so we can actually operationalize and then run these applications years into the future.
From what I heard you say was you've got companies that have limited set of resources, right? They're both in terms of people who know, who have specific skill sets, and in terms of resources they can invest on and and coordinate with. Spend the right kind of resources at the right place. Your front office is more often than not the place that requires you to have highly skilled people, and for you to have more creativity, more open thought in terms of how you're going to create the consumer experience that you have, versus for your middle and back office scenarios, you want more governance almost, and you don't want to spend heavy duty time running, managing applications in middle and back office doing just that kind of stuff. So it comes down to, where do you want to put what kind of resources? Is that what we're just talking about here?
Yeah. So if you think of an organization, you put your money where your value prop is. So if your revenue generation is typically in your product side, so your front end, what your customers interact with, what your customers buy, that's where you're going to put the operations. Now, that does get a little tricky. Like some companies, their value prop is in things like their supply chain. But even still in that kind of space, it's still your core competencies are your, what you invest your resource, time, budget into. So then when you get into things like the back office, things like accounting functions, legal services, those are critical to the actual operations of the business, but they often don't have a direct tie to the revenue chain. So where the problem is it's hard to get funding for those. So they can be incredibly inefficient, they can be underfunded, they can be under budget, but they're not directly tied to revenue, so it's harder for leadership to draw a line into how much do we invest in those areas versus how much do we, you know, a couple of years ago it was out, you know, like a decade ago it was outsource all of it. Now that didn't really go so well. So right now it's a lot of insourcing, bringing things back in, but they're still not funded anywhere near to the extent of direct revenue business operations or value chain operations. So what IT and back office functions typically have to do is they have to compete more with less, right? So they have to do just as much. They have the advantage of, yes, a lot of companies have an accounting function. A lot of companies have a legal function. All companies have a technology function. So yes, they have standard patterns for how to operate under, but they're still, I would say the ratio doesn't make up, right? So the fact that, yes, they've got repeatable patterns to run off of, but they still have to run a lot of systems to make the business go execute. So if you're in an IT, the traditional thing, IT do more with less every year, right? How do you do more with less? Why do you have less? You have less because you're not tied to revenue. You can't actually get the funding to run a business of IT. You're not a cash cow. So,
And somewhat kind of leads to, when we talk in the context of low-code platforms, what they can do and what they are doing, most low-code platform companies, and we know, of course, ServiceNow included, they're bringing to the table these pre-built applications, right? So when we say pre-built applications, we also talk in the context of what you were saying earlier, that is, we have the standards that have been defined that says, well, for CRM, we're going to be in the Salesforce space. For back office or for finance and HR kind of stuff, we're going to be in SAP and those kind of spaces. And for IT and some of the ESM, the enterprise services, we're going to be in ServiceNow space. What that does is creates, I guess, almost two things. One, it brings a lot of pre-built knowledge onto the table, because We're not saying that this is, you know, this is just an open platform being brought and, well, build whatever you want within this platform's framework. What these companies are doing is they're bringing out capabilities that are pre-built on the platform, which are then almost low code administration or low administration overhead in that case. The second thing they do is, as they do that, they're also therefore introducing almost a ready-made governance on top of things, right? So they're, the fact that this is all on one platform and the constraints, or I guess the limitations of that platform and how we do things within that platform, create that ready-made governance layer that says, I need to control that platform if I'm going to develop anything internally. More people want to get onboarded and more people want to do things on this. They can continue doing that, but it's still one controlled world, as opposed to what you said early on, which is, I've got my tool, I've got my stack, I've got this stack, I've got this pointer tool, like, you know, fit for purpose tool that's coming in and solving a purpose. Yes, in some cases, they're doing a lot more fit for purpose thing, but we've got a very disconnected environment at this point. As you and I like to call it, the alphabet soup of tools that companies end up creating.
Yeah. And a good example, I mean, a couple examples, obviously Remedy 10 years ago, 20 years ago, SAP, right? Here's the applications. I mean, that probably to an extreme, right? So the challenge with SAP and anything built in, it's really rigid. It was structured. Here's how you should run this operations in your enterprise. Kind of jumped over to things like platforms like AWS and Azure, which were kind of the opposite. It's, what do you want to run on this thing? And then if you look at tools like ServiceNow, it's like, okay, well, we're not either one of those. It's kind of right in the middle to say, yeah, we've got kind of these applications. We built this idea for a platform, the Glide platform that they put together. But then in order to actually sell the platform, they had to put some applications on it. So a lot, and to a benefit and to a, I'd say a restriction, a benefit on the benefit side, it gave that company, that particular company, an inroads into a lot of enterprises as an IT ticketing tool. To its detriment, it took a while before clients or before organizations looked at it as a low-code platform. Even many companies today look at it as just an IT ticketing tool, or even a ticketing tool in general. So pros and cons. I think the approach gave them a lot of adoption in the past, but now it's how do they move past that? And that's what they've been focused on the past few years. SAP is probably a good example. They're going into other areas of that their platform, making it more flexible in different areas. Salesforce, Force.com, that's more of a marketplace driven platform. So that's kind of less of, we're going to build your business apps, let you build your apps and sell them in a market. Although that's changing now. I think Salesforce is now kind of bringing a lot more of its own apps in house. So.
Yeah, and just one last quick thing on the whole, you know, low-code platform and their value kind of topic. This also leads to a little bit of, you know, yes, reduction in internal management. Right? I mean, if you built this software yourself, you would end up spending quite a bit of money in maintenance side of things, right? Almost, if I was to talk in the terms of stack developers, there's almost very low refactoring that is required. The product teams of these individual companies are then managing the lifecycle of their products. They're releasing new things, new features as they want. And so you are within a platform which is low code. You're designing it your way, and yet you're relying on somebody else to manage the stack. Not to mention, when you go SaaS, it's even more easier at that point. You're not managing the six different elements of the platform in this case. You're managing the one SaaS solution, the framework, the platform as it's been given to you.
Yeah, exactly. You trade management of dependencies and versions of all of the different elements of your stack. So what infrastructure you're running, if that's even relevant anymore, what application services that are running, what dependencies are running out there. You're trading all of that and handing that off to a vendor. And now you're taking in license management and vendor management, arguably. So you're bringing in kind of a more of a management function than a technical delivery function.
True. So we've talked quite a bit about the whole, you know, front office, middle office, back office. Now, one thing you and I have discussed in past in offline conversations has been this whole concept of, we all know what front end is, right? We know what front office is. It's the product that goes to the consumers. It's the, you know, the thing that we're really selling. But really, when we come to the context of what's middle office and what's back office, and how do they, how can low-code platforms help across the three offices in that case? Let's touch upon that for a little for a quick second. So, talking front, middle, and back office. First of all, in the context of industries, is there a clear definition of what's considered middle versus what's considered back office in this case?
In a given industry, or just in general across enterprises?
That's part of the question, because I think the back office part is relatively, I wouldn't say easy, but it's relatively given. But I think, at least this is my opinion, that middle office gets elevated. So middle office is basically elements of back office that get elevated because they are the front and center of the focus because of the industry that the company operates in. That's just my way of thinking about it. I have always had a difficulty figuring out what should I consider middle office, unless you're telling me which company I'm talking about, right? So if we're talking about a hedge fund, finance is middle office, right? There is back office finance that manages salaries and stuff, but a significant amount of financial functions, research and development functions, are typically the middle office for them.
Yeah, it's also two different angles, right? So if you're, it's either the dimension of how far away from you are to the value chain, or how far away from you are you to the customer. So it could kind of depend on which perspective you're taking. So a front office could be your customer support, but your customer support isn't really part of your, arguably, part of your value chain. If you're a logistics company, it is, but it's not your supply chain management system. If you're a logistics company, that's core to your business, right? So that would be front end as far as your value chain, but it's also not very front, assuming, to your customer. So
that's an interesting perspective to say it is also somewhat of the bookish definition of how far you are from the customer. But I like the perspective of how far are you from the value chain, because all of those examples that I talk about, so there's no fixed answer to this, right? We know what the front office is. It's product management. It's the functions that are related to running and managing the product side of business, the services side of business. There is the, what they call corporate services. I don't know who they are, but the corporate services are the true back office. But elements of corporate services or other services that are somewhere beyond just for the core corporate back end, but are almost facing the value chain. It's not, because I think that's one way of separating as well. Like, you can look at functions and go, is this function facing an external side or is it facing internal side? If it's facing internal side, then it's back office. If it's facing external side, it's either middle office or front office. And then the proximity from the value chain, from the customer, can tell you, well, whether are you really front office or are you middle office? So now, talking down that path, back to our low-code platforms topic, where do you think low-code platforms across different industries, and we can talk through industries, right? We can talk through, let's say, tech and healthcare and financial. Let's take those three as an example, right? So for those three industries, how do we go about thinking of where low-code platforms are most useful? Let's start with tech.
Yeah, so think about maybe high-tech, telecom, and media. Maybe start with telecom. Telecom has had back office operations, and it's kind of an odd mix because it's engineering and network operations, and there's a whole ETOM model for how that gets played out. But there's the difference between back office and a telecom, and that these are your business operations functions, right? So it's desk side services. If you're IT, it's accounting, it's legal, but legal as far as employee relations, not so much as legal for front office general counsel type legal. So the back office for telecom, but the mid office gets a little bit dicey when you get into technology and in telecom, because your mid office can overlap quite a bit with your network engineering, your network operations, because you're using your engineering services, your technology to deliver your customers' technology as well. So that's as and high tech is a little bit different in that you often have a lot of, a little more manufacturing involved in there, a little more traditional building of equipment and building of technology, depending on the industry within high tech. So there's manufacturing and high tech, and there's also high tech services. So.
So, how would you position again the concept and conversation around low-code platforms there, right? As far as I can think of, every one of these functions or services or however you want to qualify this have a very clear set of, targeted tools in the market that are available, right? You can buy a tool for, like, there's an app for everything, is what I'm trying to say. And it, of course, doesn't make sense for a business to say, I'm going to use this for everything. Like, here's the most common thing I've heard, right? I mean, I've heard of organizations using something like a Jira for everything, right? It's my back office ticketing system. It's the system that I use when I'm logging a bug in the front end. It's also the system that I use when my middle office team that's actually doing development off my front end platform is logging their bugs in. Everything's a bug in a Jira, or everything's a defect. I've heard that more often than not, right, especially from tech companies, and quite a bit in the telecom space as well. So, what value does low-code platforms provide in this space for us?
So, I mean, it solves the so it the value that it provides is it solves the problem of getting the work tracked, right? It's a very tactical, okay, I need to open up a bug and I'll track whatever type of work I have to do, whether it be a project, a transactional activity, daily business as usual operations work, log a ticket, then I can track my work. And it's out of email, right? That's a positive. It's not buried in an email ticket, email somewhere in somebody's account. Now, the problem that comes to there is almost the, one side, you've got a hammer, so everything's a nail, right? We're going to try to solve this. Everything we want to do, we're going to log it as a Jira ticket, and then there's really no advantage in your business operations with that. So if you think of think of tools on the market like Solanas trying to determine, trying to use machine learning. Yeah, trying to find efficiencies in your how you're actually delivering these processes. Well, if your work record isn't actually tracking the process itself, you've got really no data mining against that. You really limit yourself in how you're actually tracking and improving on different processes you're running. It's almost acknowledging the fact that yes, you may be a back office or mid office, but you do still have different processes you're performing.
That's a good point. Let's do a little transition, right? So we talked about how tech companies and telecom companies, there's very clear option of using low code platforms, definitely for the back office, but a little bit for the middle office as well. Let's talk for a second, healthcare, life sciences kind of space, right? So middle office there is a way different ball game, right? I mean, because we're to be fair, front office is we're talking about people's lives in a lot of cases. Middle office is closer to that front facing, but it's still very important stuff because in more often than not conditions, you're talking about billing systems, and you're talking about systems that track health, systems that track how the payer provider relationships and things like that. So
Medical coding, medical billing, yep.
exactly. So in that space, is that somewhere you would see the value of low-code platforms? Or is that somewhere you stick to a little more on the fit for purpose, this tool is made exactly for this thing kind of solution?
It's a typical consultant answer. It depends. So if we talk about medical devices, there's obviously a lot of embedded systems in those. If you talk about in healthcare, if you talk about like EHR systems. So tools on the market like Epic, I mean, those are already fit for purpose for what they're trying to solve in medical records management. Now, getting a step beyond that of actually tracking other types of operations, asset management. Assets management has been a typical challenge at a lot of healthcare industries. It's just lots of financially important assets to track, lots of compliance and governance associated with different types of medical devices. So low-code platforms definitely have a place to set in there to help track those. If especially in the scenarios where there's not really a particular industry, if there's not a particularly flexible industry tool in the market for it, right? So if you're a if you're in an industry, and say you're a network of hospital systems, and you want to track your asset management across the hospitals that your network owns, so maybe it's an owned group of hospitals. So if you want to track the assets across those, or you probably need some more robust functionality than off-the-shelf software. You might want to classify and codify those assets a little bit differently. You might want to manage their life cycles differently and ownership. And so the low-code platform element of that gives you a space in which to define those and actually start putting a business process around that to improve.
Cool. One quick kind of area that I also want to touch on from an industry standpoint is financial services, right? Because this is another one of those spaces where I think we play in a space where it is more than just it's one of those middle offices are an elevated version of a back office scenario, especially when we talk financial services. And I guess we can take all the fintech, insurtech in the same conversation as well, because as these organizations are more and more reliant or need to be compliant of government regulations, ours included in some context of the phrase, they need solutions that are, I'd say, the elevated and broader versions of back office solutions, especially in compliance management, risk management type spaces, right? So is that one of the places where you'd say the combination of the pre-built side of the world as well as the low-code platform combined could be very useful?
Yeah, if you think of lots of finance applications and, you know, AML and know your customer types of operations, there's plenty of systems in the market that cover those. But I think a space for low code activities or low code platforms to play would be in how does that work get done? Right. So how are you actually tracking the work of your employees and the backlog of activities that have to take place that your knowledge workers are actually being tasked with? A lot of things are still done in email. Even if you're using machine learning to track your AML activities, once those are flagged, once those are actually tagged against some operation needing to have to occur on that, yes, you can automate a good amount of that. But you still have to track that. You still have to govern how the automation is taking place. You still have to ultimately at some point push out work potentially to a human worker. How do you track that work is being done? And how do you pass it back and forth? So I think there's a big market in financial operations to play in that space.
Awesome. So Adam, thanks for your time. I think we've actually spent about 30 minutes already on this call. And what I would love to do is quickly wrap up, because nobody wants to listen to a podcast more than 30 minutes long. If you're still with us and still listening to it, thank you very much. As Adam and I mentioned, if you guys need to reach out to us, wherever this podcast gets published, you will see our contact information. Feel free to reach out. Adam, I really wanted to touch upon this because this is our first podcast and we're going to do one a month, as we had discussed. So what are you thinking of the topic for the next month? Just as a sneak peek for what people might be interested in. Are we thinking ESM? Are we thinking more around the AI space? We've talked about all sorts of topics. So what are you thinking?
So one thing, as you and I have discussed, I'd like to jump into more is the ESM topic. So that thing, enterprise service delivery, enterprise service management, enterprise service definition, employee service delivery, whatever we want to call ESM. There's a number of different usage of that term. And then there's some frameworks in the past that have come and gone around how do you define deliver services in a company beyond IT? So I think that'd be fun to dive into.
Perfect. Once again, Adam, thank you very much for joining. And for everybody who's still listening and who listened to us, thank you very much for paying attention.
Thank you, sir.
We'll talk to you soon.